She heard nothing from him or about him for a year. When she began to hear gossip and to read newspaper stories, she did not believe at first that they referred to Francisco d'Anconia. After a while, she had to believe it. She read the story of the party he gave on his yacht in the harbor of Valparaiso. The guests wore bathing suits, and an artificial rain of champagne and flower petals kept falling upon the decks throughout the night. She read the story of the party he gave at an Algerian desert resort. He built a pavilion of thin sheets of ice and presented every woman guest with an ermine wrap as a gift to be worn for the occasion, on condition that they remove their wraps, then their evening gowns, then all the rest, in tempo with the melting of the walls. She read the accounts of the business ventures he undertook at lengthy intervals. The ventures were spectacularly successful and ruined his competitors, but he indulged in them as in an occasional sport, staging a sudden raid, then vanishing from the industrial scene for a year or two, leaving d'Anconia Copper to the management of his employees. She read the interview where he said, "Why should I wish to make money? I have enough to permit three generations of descendants to have as good a time as I'm having." She saw him once at a reception given by an ambassador in New York. He bowed to her courteously, he smiled, and he looked at her with a glance in which no past existed. She drew him aside. She said only, "Francisco, why?" "Why what?" he asked. She turned away. "I warned you," he said. She did not try to see him again. She survived it. She was able to survive it because she did not believe in suffering. She faced with astonished indignation the ugly fact of feeling pain and refused to let it matter. Suffering was a senseless accident. It was not part of life as she saw it. She would not allow pain to become important. She had no name for the kind of resistance she offered, for the emotion from which the resistance came. But the words that stood as its equivalent in her mind were, "It does not count. It is not to be taken seriously." She knew these were the words, even in the moments when there was nothing left within her but screaming, and she wished she could lose the faculty of consciousness so that it would not tell her that what could not be true was true. Not to be taken seriously. An immovable certainty within her kept repeating, "Pain and ugliness are never to be taken seriously." She fought it. She recovered. Years helped her to reach the day when she could face her memories indifferently. Then the day when she felt no necessity to face them. It was finished, and of no concern to her any longer. There had been no other men in her life. She did not know whether this had made her unhappy. She had had no time to know. She found the clean, brilliant sense of life as she wanted it in her work. Once Francisco had given her the same sense, a feeling that belonged with her work and in her world. The men she had met since were like the men she met at her first ball. She had won the battle against her memories, but one form of torture remained, untouched by the years, the torture of the word, "Why?" Whatever the tragedy he met, why had Francisco taken the ugliest way of escape? As ignoble as the way of some cheap alcoholic. The boy she had known could not have become a useless coward. An incomparable mind could not turn its ingenuity to the invention of melting ballrooms. Yet he had, and did. And there was no explanation to make it conceivable, and to let her forget him in peace. She could not doubt the fact of what he had been. She could not doubt the fact of what he had become. Yet one made the other impossible. At times she almost doubted her own rationality, or the existence of any rationality anywhere. But this was a doubt which she did not permit to anyone. Yet there was no explanation, no reason, no clue to any conceivable reason, and in all the days of 10 years she had found no hint of an answer. "No," she thought, as she walked through the gray twilight past the windows of abandoned shops to the Wayne Falkland Hotel. No, there could be no answer. She would not seek it. It did not matter now. The remnant of violence, the emotion rising as a thin trembling within her, was not for the man she was going to see. It was a cry of protest against a sacrilege, against the destruction of what had been greatness. In a break between buildings, she saw the towers of the Wayne Falkland. She felt a slight jolt in her lungs and legs that stopped her for an instant. Then she walked on evenly. By the time she walked through the marble lobby to the elevator, then down the wide velvet-carpeted soundless corridors of the Wayne Falkland, she felt nothing but a cold anger that grew colder with every step. She was certain of the anger when she knocked at his door. She heard his voice answering, "Come in." She jerked the door open and entered. Francisco Domingo Carlos Andrés Sebastián Danconia sat on the floor playing marbles. Nobody ever wondered whether Francisco Danconia was good-looking or not. It seemed irrelevant. When he entered a room, it was impossible to look at anyone else. His tall, slender figure had an air of distinction, too authentic to be modern, and he moved as if he had a cape floating behind him in the wind. People explained him by saying that he had the vitality of a healthy animal, but they knew dimly that that was not correct. He had the vitality of a healthy human being, a thing so rare that no one could identify it. He had the power of certainty. Nobody described his appearance as Latin, yet the word applied to him, not in its present, but in its original sense, not pertaining to Spain, but to ancient Rome. His body seemed designed as an exercise in consistency of style, a style made of gauntness, of tight flesh, long legs, and swift movements. His features had the fine precision of sculpture. His hair was black and straight, swept back. The suntan of his skin intensified the startling color of his eyes. They were a pure, clear blue. His face was open, its rapid changes of expression reflecting whatever he felt, as if he had nothing to hide. The blue eyes were still and changeless, never giving a hint of what he thought. He sat on the floor of his drawing room dressed in sleeping pajamas of thin black silk. The marbles spread on the carpet around him were made of the semi-precious stones of his native country, carnelian and rock crystal. He did not rise when Dagny entered. He sat looking up at her, and a crystal marble fell like a teardrop out of his hand. He smiled the unchanged, insolent, brilliant smile of his childhood. "Hi, Slug." She heard herself answering irresistibly, helplessly, happily, "Hi, Frisco." She was looking at his face. It was the face she had known. It bore no mark of the kind of life he had led, nor of what she had seen on their last night together. There was no sign of tragedy, no bitterness, no tension. Only the radiant mockery, matured and stressed. The look of dangerously unpredictable amusement, and the great guiltless serenity of spirit. But this she thought was impossible. This was more shocking than all the rest. His eyes were studying her, the battered coat thrown open, half slipping off her shoulders, and the slender body in a gray suit that looked like an office uniform. "If you came here dressed like this in order not to let me notice how lovely you are," he said, "you miscalculated. You're lovely. I wish I could tell you what a relief it is to see a face that's intelligent, though a woman's, but you don't want to hear it. That's not what you came here for." The words were improper in so many ways, yet were said so lightly that they brought her back to reality, to anger, and to the purpose of her visit. She remained standing, looking down at him, her face blank, refusing him any recognition of the personal, even of its power to offend her. She said, "I came here to ask you a question."
"Go ahead."
"When you told those reporters that you came to New York to witness the farce, which farce did you mean?" He laughed aloud, like a man who seldom finds a chance to enjoy the unexpected. "That's what I like about you, Dagny. There are 7 million people in the city of New York at present. Out of 7 million people, you were the only one to whom it could have occurred that I wasn't talking about the veiled divorce scandal."
"What were you talking about?"
"What alternative occurred to you? The San Sebastian disaster? That's much more amusing than the veiled divorce scandal, isn't it?"
She said in the solemn, merciless tone of a prosecutor, "You did it consciously, cold-bloodedly, and with full intention. Don't you think it would be better if you took your coat off and sat down?"